Hello, everyone, and welcome to Four Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comics and manga podcast. I'm your host, Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Rob.
Hello.
And Mick.
Hello.
So, how are we both doing today?
Well, I must admit, I'm enjoying the feeling of being quite dry, because it's been a miserable few days, weather-wise.
Yes. Painting has been sending fumes around the house, so it's been a little bit interesting.
That'll have led to some interesting interpretation of the artwork in your comics today.
I like that we're going to have a whole like paint fumes era of the podcast.
Yeah. I particularly liked it when the demons danced off the page and into my eyes.
That's great. Actually, yeah, listeners, if you want extra content, just, you know, replace all our audio with random David Bowie lyrics. Anyway, I'm excited because today I've completely flipped the script, brought about possibly a new innovation in podcasting.
What?
What I've done right is I've taken my microphone and instead of just kind of precariously hanging it within a nest of random wires and side tables, just put it on a desk instead.
It'll never take off.
That's the idea of putting it on a desk.
It's one of those things, Andrew, where people will mock you in your lifetime, and then in 100 years' time, podcasters of the future will go, that Andrew Young, he was onto something here.
Gosh, once they read the forbidden texts.
You'll be the Nikolai Tesla of podcasting.
Oh no. Does that mean some big American podcast is going to take all the credit?
Yep.
But
well, at least I'll have the better mustache, and that's the important point.
Whilst using your technology to kill criminals.
Yes. But at some point in the future, in the far future, people will make games about you and, you know, somebody might name a car after you.
And you'll also feature as a weird character in an Amanda Tapping sci-fi series. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, truly, when God closes a door, he opens a window.
Absolutely.
Anyway, should we talk about some comics?
Yes.
Yes.
So, yeah, we have got another round of comic reviews this week. This time really kind of delving into the depths of the stuff we've received from Turnaround Books. So I think it's going to be an interesting show because this is basically all the stuff we'd usually go, yeah, I'll get around to that at some point. And this is that point.
This is the stuff that only gets reviewed in the event of a pandemic.
Well, we literally have no other comics to talk about.
It's anyway. It's about now that they should release The Inkle 2.
Is that Hodorowski's Boogaloo?
Sorry?
So to kick Boogaloo. Us off, I have got Gwar, the Enormogantic Fail. Wow, I got that name right on the first try.
That's impressive. Now do it again, 3 times fast.
No, Mick, we're not doing that. And we are deleting all the audio from before the show started. None must ever know. So this was written by Matt Miner and Matt McGuire, with art by a whole host of people, including Matt McGuire, Leanna Kangas, Katie Longua, Matt Harding, Clay Hens, Jeff Martin, Lucas Kowalskik, and Matt Young. So this book tells the story of Gwar, or Gwar, I guess, maybe. Like G War, but also Raw. Yeah, Gwar. I'm going to go with Gwar. That makes more sense to me. Who are basically a band of sort of space barbarians in service to a sinister figure known only as the Master, who are fighting an intergalactic war against the differently evil Cardinal Sin.
That's a very politically correct phrasing, the differently evil.
Cardinal Sin is calling him it's a bit on the nose, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't give you much room for character depth.
Yes, and also when your main characters are the ones kind of burning down villages and eating the inhabitants, it's kind of hard to call the other side the villains.
It's blurring the lines somewhat, isn't it?
Yes. So, yes, the story follows Gwar as they are kind of put on trial after basically botching a mission against Cardinal Sin, in which they attacked the wrong planet and Cardinal Sin was able to steal some of the precious Gizmoglobin.
The what?
The Gizmoglobin.
That's what I thought you said.
This book also has a character called the Sexecutioner.
What?
So yeah, basically, Gwar are put on trial after watching this mission, and what follows is kind of a Rashomon-style retelling of what exactly caused the mission to go wrong from just perspectives of various members of the troop. Anyway, this comic, hated it. Thought it was just, it was very crude in a not like hugely enjoyable way. I mean, mainly because it's always just a, it's called Gizmoglobin. Do you get it? It's got the word jizz in it. That's funny.
Is it like the kind of humour that teenagers find funny, but you just kind of go, nah?
Yeah. It's very kind of teeny, sort of Rick and Morty turned up to 11 kind of humour.
Oh.
And so I didn't like it. I am willing to be a bit more lenient on it than I was originally, because I was also quite confused. Like, I didn't really know if I was supposed to be aware of who Gwar were and, like, what their deal was.
I know they're some kind of Scandinavian black metal band, is it? Or...
Yes, that's right. I did do some digging. Apparently they are, like, a heavy metal band. And the point, like, their gimmick is all the members do kind of dress up in costume and take the role of these kind of characters, you know, like your Sexecutioners, your Blothars.
Oh, your... Do you know, I think I happened across this in a free comic book day thing. They were like a guest star in a sort of horror comic type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they might have been. And I think like their whole shtick is their shows do include kind of lots of fake blood, sort of violence and, you know, fake other bodily fluids. And I can kind of, you know, I can kind of see if that is your kind of thing, that probably is, you know, quite a fun experience. You know, if you're standing in the crowd and a big, like, wave of fake blood comes and hits you in the face. So I guess, you know, if you are that kind of fan, you probably will get something out of this. But as someone who is just reading this as a comic book with no real prior knowledge of the band, it's just, it's hard to see, first of all, why I should care and what the humour is. Like, literally, the central joke is seemingly that the reason they accidentally went to the wrong planet is just that they accidentally went to the wrong planet.
Oh.
Yeah. Also, here's a really funny bit. So there's one of the characters who's a big green monster guy. And one of the other characters says to him, "Get out of my way, you ninja turtle." Do you get it? Because it's like the Teenage Ninja Turtles, and that's a reference I understand, so that's funny. But it's got a whole nother layer of it. Because he's a space barbarian, so how does he even know who the Ninja Turtles are? And so ultimately, I think I'm just jealous that I could never attain, you know, that level of high-quality humour. It's just not very good. I mean, I guess the art, I will say, I quite like. Like, it's got a fun sort of, like, Saturday morning cartoon, but quite, like, gory and twisted look, which I think works for sort of what the book is going for.
Yeah.
Oh, also, all the aliens that they're killing, they all have butts for heads.
Of course they do.
But yeah, but I mean, if just the very idea of an alien with a head that looks like a bit like a body as you're rolling in stitches, book's probably for you.
Yeah.
I'll give that a miss, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't care about this book any to talk about it anymore, so why don't you two do a thing?
I'll go next then. Since you've done something awful, I will do something good.
Hooray, balance.
Yes, there is balance in the podcast. The balance, weirdly enough, is also found from someone who is decidedly evil and mischievous and all sorts of other words you could use. Possibly more evil than Gwar. Loki, Agent of Asgard, is what I have.
Is Loki evil or is he just misunderstood?
He's evil, definitely.
Okay, alright.
this is the thing, we'll get into the evil part, alright, because there is a story here and it's a good one. So this collects Loki, Agent of Asgard 1-17, Original Sin 5.1-5.5, and material from All New Marvel Now 0.1, number 1. And it's written by Al Ewing and Jason Aaron, with illustrations by Lee Garbett, Joe Coelho, Simone Bianchi, and a whole lot more, because there is. There's a bunch of people putting in some solid effort here. So anyway, you've got all of this, and it's by Al Ewing with Jason Aaron, and he did the core plot on Original Sin 5.1 to 5.5. But most of this is Al Ewing, and it shows. Al Ewing has become one of my favourite writers in Marvel, partly because of this, partly because of... Al Ewing does Immortal Hulk, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
But
I think this was the series that definitely like kind of got me to be definitely paying attention to him.
Yeah, and it's understandable why, because the writing in this... the writing in Loki, Agent of Asgard, is... It's next-level comic book stuff. I mean, this has taken Loki in directions that you just would never have imagined a character like Loki could head in the first place. Not only is it putting a new spin on Loki and showing Loki in a different light, it's also showing the depth and complexity of his schemes. They're not just schemes within schemes. They're schemes within schemes that look like truths, but maybe schemes, but you're not sure until they become schemes, but they may be the truth by that point, because he may have changed history so that the truth becomes the scheme and the scheme becomes the truth. And all that while being dead, supposedly. Oh no, being reborn, but also being the sin that can never be forgiven.
Yes, because he killed his own child self.
Yeah. The first story is the All New Marvel Now 0.1. Where it has Loki going around gathering a bunch of keys from that Odin made, and the keys open the locks for him to get hold of Sigurd, the first Asgardian hero, his sword Garm, which is the truth sword. Anyone stabbed by it will have the truth of themselves revealed to themselves, and sometimes it can kill, but also sometimes it can save.
Yes, sometimes the truth is just... Oh, Jesus, you stabbed him with a sword. That hurts a lot.
Yeah. There's a fantastic scene in this, because Loki's first mission, because he's working for the All-Mother, who is Gaia, Freya, and Idun. And Loki's first job is, trust me, and the first scene you see is Loki standing behind Thor, stabbing him through the chest from the back with a magic sword, and says, "Trust me, I know what I'm doing." It's the kind of scene that says a lot, but doesn't tell you anything at exactly the same time. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, okay, I want to know more. What happened to end up in that situation? You find out the truth of what's happening in that scene, but the All-Mother keeps appearing in different places for Loki, you know, in the mirror when he's just come out of the shower, in a bowl of punch, floating above his new carpet after he's moved. And it turns out that Loki has to kind of gather his troops to try and continue his missions. And he's got a woman who can tell when someone's lying. She can see lies. Lorelei, who is the younger sister of the Enchantress, and they don't get on, apparently. Thor, who is kind of best buds again with this new, younger, hipper version of Loki. And also kind of Sigurd, who is kind of working for Loki, but also not. It all gets very, very complicated, but it's such a fun ride all the way through.
Yeah. I mean, basically, it's as complicated as you would expect from a comic book spy drama based on Norse mythology.
Yes. There's one bit where Loki's kind of going, yeah, I found the town Thrall. And Thor goes, let's go see if we can find my sister. And like, are you sure that's a good idea? Thor's his typical, yes, it's a good idea, because I thought of it. It wasn't a good idea. So, yeah.
I like it when Thor and Loki get along.
They
make a fun pair together.
See, that's the thing. I think Thor and Loki could have so much more fun if they were working together. And the times when they do work together, when young Thor and young Loki work together, it's a lot of fun. When it's old Loki, it's not as much fun, because old Loki is the god of evil. And it explains that the Asgardian gods are creatures of myth and legend. And so it's what Pratchett used to call narrative causality. So the more Loki is defined by humans as doing evil deeds, the more he becomes the god of evil, until he's no longer the god of mischief, he's simply the god of evil.
Yeah, I do like, there's like quite a lot of stuff about, you know, like predetermination.
Yeah.
There's like destiny, and how much choice do you have in how you're defined?
Yeah. I mean,
as well as like a bunch of meta narrative stuff, because Loki's like the god of stories as well.
Exactly. And so he, more than any other god, is subject to what other people and other humans in particular, or other mortals, what they believe he is. He's subject to that. So if they believe he's a good god, then he will become a good god. But if they believe he is, you know, he's a being only capable of evil, he will become the god of evil again.
Yes, and not to undermine your point, but I am now just picturing Thor kind of patting Loki on the head and going, who's a good god? You are. Yes, you are.
See, I could see that happening. Oh, hell. This continues on. I mean, even to the point where, even past the point where Thor loses his hammer and keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. And it's this bizarre thing that only the person who is writing the Immortal Hulk could come up with such a convoluted but fascinating story. You know when a kid is trying to explain what happened to his homework to the teacher? Yeah. You know, like a five-year-old is trying to explain what happened to that spelling he was supposed to do last night, and they come up with this fascinating story which has no bearing on reality whatsoever, but somehow aliens and Superman and Spider-Man were involved.
Yes, I think also maybe the thing to point out is that Loki, Agent of Asgard, is a convoluted story, but not a confusing read.
No, that's the thing. It is, like, it's convoluted, yeah. But it clearly explains the logic behind all of it, and you actually do follow the story completely. It's not confusing in the slightest. That's what makes it fascinating. When you try and write stories that are really complex, it's easy to trip over yourself. It's easy to forget little details here and there that might come back to bite you in the ass later on. But with this, Al Ewing's done an amazing job just keeping all of the different threads balanced and all of the, you know, all of the plot points kind of, he's juggling them all like a master storyteller. It's great.
Yeah, I'd love to see like Al Ewing's story writing room, because there must just be like pages and pages of things stuck to the walls and like string connecting different bits. Like just a big conspiracy wall of story notes.
Can you imagine, though, because Jason Aaron worked with him on a little bit on the original Sin, 5.1 to 5.5. And can you imagine Jason Aaron just knocking on Al Ewing's office door going, Al, can we talk about the story a bit? Walking in, there's just this crazy wall of Loki, Agent of Asgard.
Yeah, like maybe there's just a giant pile of notes in the centre and Al Ewing just sort of emerges out of it.
Yes. So yeah, Loki, Agent of Asgard, if you are a fan of the Thor comics, if you're a fan of Norse mythology, if you're a fan of just really good storytelling in comics, then you owe it to yourself to read Loki, Agent of Asgard. It is next level comic book storytelling.
Yeah, I feel like we've been using the terms if you are a fan of quite differently, because man was definitely, I do not understand this thing, but I guess someone must like it. Whereas just if you like good things, you probably like this.
Well, yeah, that's why my third point was, if you're a fan of good storytelling in comics.
Yeah, I just mean, with Gwar, if you're a fan, was definitely much more of a qualifier.
Yeah, this is true. So anyway,
the face that was doing a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah, yes it was. So, who's next?
Wake up from your nap, Mick. It's time to talk about a comic.
It's not easy to wait. I did a 10-mile run before doing this podcast, you know.
I mean, that sounds very much like your fault.
I wasn't blaming anyone else, but I'm just saying that a nap would be quite nice. Okay, so I'm doing Jughead, The Hunger versus Vampironica from Archie Comics. So for those of you not in the know with Archie Comics, which includes, well, me mainly, there is a sort of dark Archie universe. Well, several dark Archie universes. You've got Jughead, The Hunger, which is like the Riverdale Archie comics, but where Jughead is a werewolf.
I wouldn't put it past Riverdale to have a season where Jughead becomes a werewolf.
And the Vampironica universe is where Veronica is a vampire, but Jughead's normal. So
they're two separate universes.
They are two separate universes.
Sure, Archie, sure.
But this, Jughead the Hunger versus Vampironica, is basically Crisis on Infinite Riverdales, as their supernatural universes all come crashing together in one exciting crossover event, he said, quoting some blurb.
Okay.
So, it starts off with Veronica having, in her own universe, wiped out the granddaddy of all vampires, Dracula, and therefore removing all vampires from the world and making everyone safe in their beds at night in a very Buffy-style way. She's still got slightly pointy teeth, but as far as she's concerned, this is just a hangover from her days as Vampironica. And so her and the gang are round at Pop's place, and they're about to slice into a congratulatory cake, ready to celebrate this thing going on. Unfortunately, their festivities are interrupted by the appearance of three vampires, who promptly attack Pop and kill him. And then we go through a series of tests where someone exposes their... Why they hadn't done this before, after the death of Dracula, I don't know. But basically someone cuts themselves with a knife and offers the palm up to Veronica to see if she's cured of being a vampire. And as she starts drinking hungrily from the exposed vein, it becomes clear that maybe not all is as it seems.
Right, so basically just everyone assumed all the vampires were gone but didn't bother to check.
Yeah, some rudimentary post-project checking didn't take place. And she goes back to her folks to ask some very serious probing questions about her family history. And it turns out that the night she got turned into a vampire by a guy called Ivan wasn't actually when she became a vampire. She's always been one. And so have her parents. And so on and so forth. In a long line of vampires going all the way back to the granddaddy of all vampires back in the day. And this little revelation brings to an end the first chapter. We then go into another Riverdale. A Riverdale where Jughead is a vampire. And similarly, we go through a whole process of getting a history lesson about how there are no vampires in the world because there was a big war between vampires and werewolves, and werewolves won by ambushing the granddaddy of all vampires that you may remember from my synopsis of the last bit.
And is that a different vampire to Dracula?
Yes, this is Veronica's great, 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 great granddaddy.
Okay.
Oh, so literally the granddaddy of vampires.
Yeah, but what keeps happening is that vampires from Veronica's universe or Vampironica's universe keep fading in and out of existence, and people from the werewolf universe keep fading in and out of existence, and there's a lot of cross-universe shenanigans is the best way to describe it. And then there's a guest appearance by Sabrina, who starts telling everybody what's actually going on and has the line, if you want to save the world, if you want to save multiple worlds, you're going to have to listen to what I'm about to tell you very closely.
That sounds like something from Allo Allo. Listen to me very closely. Yes, yeah. It's only once.
And then we get like a Riverdale style explanation of the multiverse. Sabrina explains how the walls between are falling in, and that basically the only way to save the universe is by finding a magical book. She then possesses a sword, which gets wielded by Vampironica. And all this is told in sort of the traditional Archie art style as well. And it is quite nice. It does play around with some of the tropes. There are mysterious vampire hunters. There's, you know, legendary sort of bad blood feuds going through history, through small families within Riverdale. And it turns out that Riverdale's always had a supernatural history. And in some of the universes, things are a lot more normal than they are in others. It's not the greatest comic I've ever read, but it's actually quite a good-natured romp that pokes a fun at a few sort of poor-faced tropes from some of the more serious corners of the comic book world. It is a full story. It's contained. It's got a couple of little epilogues to show you how things pan out in the next set of adventures for each respective universe. And then you've got a free comic included, which is Vampironica New Blood. She returns to her own universe, still a vampire, and she's on the hunt for answers. But she may not be ready for what she's about to uncover. The thing is, the story could have been really naff, but I think Frank Thierry has done some fantastic writing here for me to enjoy it. And it's a universe I don't really sort of know much about. I'm aware of it. But yeah. The art by Pat and Tim Kennedy and Joe Eisma is exactly what you'd expect from Archie comics, but used to tell a much darker story than you'd normally expect. But it's still got that sort of valley-speak teen humour around it. So it's kind of like Buffy Light. So yeah, enjoyable. I mean, not something that I'd want to read every week, but as a once now and again break from all the superhero madness, it was quite enjoyable.
Cool.
So I think that maintained balance, didn't it?
Yes.
We've had bad, we've had a good, and we've had it's all right. So it's over to Andrew now to try and maintain that balance.
Oh, God, so we're going to need another. I was just thinking, do we have. Because I've got a good. So we'll just have to hope everything works out from there.
Well, I have a bad and a reasonable.
There you go. Balance maintained.
So do you want me to go first since you've got what? Actually, no, you've got a good. So you go.
Yeah, okay. So I have been reading from Humanoids, Juan Jimenez's The Fourth Power. Which
no, I've not read the first three.
I see what you did there.
See, do you know, There was a movie years ago, a horror movie called The First Power, which was all about the devil. It was like the third power was he can be anywhere, second power he can be anyone, and then never explained what the first power was. You had to watch the movie. So please tell
me. It's a bit of a naff movie if it gives away the whole twist, just like in the promo text, isn't it?
Well, that was when they used to be able to do trailers properly. Now they just tell you what the fourth power is and, you know. So anyway, please say this does explain what the fourth power is.
This does indeed. To specify, the fourth power is precognition, the ability to know that you're going to be in danger before the danger happens. So this book is set kind of in the far future. Humanity's, you know, expanded to the stars, where a race of alien called the Alpha Nebula is the place where the battles happen. The aliens are called the Cromuans. Begins with a K. There's a lot of weird made up European names in this. One of the characters is called like Hexatha Mega.
A what?
Hexatha Mega. That just sounds.
I mean, it sounds like.
I mean, it yes, sounds like. All names are technically just sounds, but that one's. especially
particularly just soundy.
Yeah, but it sounds like something you'd scream when you just stubbed your little toe, but there's kids around and you don't want to swear.
Must be sorry. Future alien race at war with you. They decide to kind of build a super weapon, which is basically what they call the quad brain, where they take the brain of four women with extraordinary, use that to make one super brain, which, vast psychic powers, and then put that in an army of clones so that they can finally turn the tide of war. Well, unfortunately for them, it doesn't go quite to plan. One of the scientists decides to rebel and free the... I don't think it's ever really given a name, but basically the woman who is made from sticking all the four brains together, he decides to free her, and she sort of goes on the run and ends up joining with a dying woman in space to become our main character, who is mercifully the much easier to remember named Gal.
That is easier to remember, isn't it?
But yeah, it's just this kind of big, weird sci-fi epic that I enjoyed a lot. Like, especially because the art in this is really great. Like, it's very highly detailed. There are lots of cool scenes. Like, just when the quad brain lady decides to destroy the research lab she was held in. And it's just like this massive sphere of energy that sort of wipes out a big chunk of the planet. Yeah, it's just very fun, like, pulpy sci-fi adventures. Like, there's a bit where Gal and her companion Jack get stranded on an alien planet where the vegetation's kind of alive and constantly growing. And that's just some very nice sort of almost Predator-esque, trapped in a jungle trying to survive type stuff. And I think, I'm just going to look up who the translators are, because they did a very good job on this. Because I know with a lot of the humanoid stuff, I think I've been a bit down on them, especially because the dialogue can read a bit weird. Like, from where it's just been translated not super well, but Justin Kelly, Jonathan Tanner, and Christy Stiles actually do a very good job with this. And I think they also managed to put some lettering in, so certain words will be bolded for emphasis. And it's one of those things that we don't notice a lot in the comics we read, but does actually make a huge difference. Like, with some of the other humanoids books, where the dialogue is just kind of very sort of standardized, just like a Microsoft Word text box, then I feel like that can make some of the books just lose a big chunk of their desired effect. But no, but with this, does a pretty decent job. That being said, there are kind of one or two places where it can be a bit tough to tell which character is supposed to be speaking. But to be honest, for a lot of it, it seems like it doesn't matter too much, because it seems to be more just like expositional scenes. Like, what planet is that? Oh, that's the green hell, where all the vegetation is constantly growing. Better not land there. Oh no, we're landing there.
The green hell?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's green. It's not particularly pleasant. It's certainly a more refreshing name than like Chromium 7 Beta or whatever.
Oh, what was the other one?
Yeah, it's got. I'm going to see if I can find out like specifically what it is. Chromians, that's the name of the aliens.
Chromians?
Yeah, they're really shiny.
Fortunately, they're not. They mostly just look like humans, but with like weird face tattoos.
Aw, that's disappointing.
I know. Mm-hmm. Okay, no, I can't find it. I can tell you the rest of the women's names, though, who make up the quad brain.
Okay.
So there is Eleona Nogent, Colleen Sagan, and who's our final contestant? They're actually comparatively normally named Sinita Connor.
Sinita Connor?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then like Exa Heather Mega.
Exa. You're going to have to go that over that one a lot slower because it just doesn't sound right. Exa Heather Mega.
Look, I don't think we can say it as many times as we want. It's not going to make it make sense.
I don't want it to make sense. I'm trying to say it.
I think what we need to do is accept that Andrew said it so that you don't have to.
Yeah, this is true.
And now he's gone quiet.
He has. Yeah, I was flicking through this. But yeah, for the most part, it's just very fun, pulpy, Flash Gordon style sci-fi comics, but like probably a bit darker.
Cool.
But yeah, it's something Flash Gordon inspired, I would guess, is probably like the better term.
Yeah. That's fair enough.
That being said, there does seem to be a strange trend in future fashion for clothing that barely covers ladies' intimate parts and can fly off like in the slightest gust of wind.
I think that's just a trend in comic books in general, isn't it?
I mean, to be fair, you likened it to sort of pulp sci-fi stories. It's a trope in those as well.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. It's accurate, at least.
So over to me then, yes?
Yeah, back to you.
So yeah. we've had bad, we've had good, we've had neutral, we've had good. So let's have bad.
Yeah, as much as we made fun of the names, I did enjoy Fourth Power quite a good deal.
So yeah, like I said, let's have bad. And you can tell it's bad when it's a spin-off of something that's really popular for a start, but on the cover it says Neat, spelled N-E-E-T, which is more a derogatory term than anything else to anyone who's in the know about Japanese pop culture and Japanese culture and tradition in general. Neat is a derogatory term that means not in education, employment, or training, and it's usually used to refer to people who are happy sitting on benefits and not actually doing anything productive with their lives. You know, they don't want to work. They're happy to basically just be internet warriors talking about stuff that they have no experience in.
I am quite disappointed, though, that it's not just like all the reviews on the back of the book are just neat, nifty, keen. I read it.
See, that's the thing. If it was that, I would be more interested in this. But there is a story that's been doing the rounds. It's a light novel that's been out for a while called The Rise of the Shield Hero. It's a light novel that's become very, very popular over in Japan and in other countries. And it's a basic story where four people get transported to another world, so it's got that common plot thread. One becomes the sword hero, one becomes the spear hero, one becomes the bow hero, and the last one becomes the shield hero. But the shield hero is, for some reason, hated by that particular kingdom. The guy who becomes the shield hero doesn't know why. He just thinks, all right, okay, along for the adventure, and then I get to go home afterwards. Gets framed for stuff and basically becomes hunted and hated by everybody and doesn't know what he's done to deserve that. All he's done is be transported to another world, and now he's being put upon by the people there. So naturally, he kind of turns in on himself and starts hating everybody. So yeah, it's the typical dark fantasy story type thing, but it has its moments of brevity, it has its moments of action, it has some interesting ways of looking at the fantasy setting. This, however, is the reprise of the Spear Hero, and this is by Aneko Yusagi with character designs by Minami Sera, and this is out from One Piece Books. This is the first volume, and I will not be reading the second volume because, frankly, I hate this. I hate this with a passion that's almost holy. There is a bit in the Rise of the Shield Hero where the main character has basically a chocobo. Anyone who's familiar with Final Fantasy knows it's a chocobo. But the chocobo can transform into a human, transforms into a young girl, right?
Oh, no.
Yes. The spear hero falls in love with the chocobo when it's still a chocobo.
Oh, no, it is Comet the Super Horse.
It is Comet the Super Horse, but in reverse, because the spear hero knows that it's basically a big chicken that he's fallen in love with. This is a story of when the spear hero goes back in time. So not only has he been transported to another world, he goes back in time as well. And he's trying to defend the shield hero and trying to be friends with the shield hero because he wants to marry the chocobo. So, yeah. Absolute twaddle. Utter crap. Seriously, Japan, do better next time.
I think it's harsh of you to berate an entire nation.
I will berate the entire nation, right? They know exactly what's wrong with the anime and manga industry, and yet they refuse to fix it.
Yes, the rest of Japan might not have written it, but they stood by and let this happen.
If they're not part of the solution.
Yeah. People who want to write this twaddle, just tell them to stand in a corner or, you know, actually go read something decent for a change. Maybe go read some classics. There are plenty of them from loads of different countries.
Go topple statues of Pokemon.
Please, yes. Because that's another thing I'm sick of.
Oh, no. We finally come for the Pokemon. We're finally casting down the false idol Pikachu.
Yep.
Yes. See, this is the thing, right? The original light novel series, which is by Aniko Usagi. Yeah. So Neat is actually the person who did this. No wonder it's tripe. Aniko Usagi wasn't the one who even touched this. Neat, it's some person who goes by the name of Neat. Oh. Moving on, Andrew. I'm tired of talking about it.
I mean, I guess if you're a writer, that's not technically employment, is it? Because you're kind of working for yourself.
Yeah, but when you're basically taking someone else's story and you're basically saying, you know, this part was interesting. There were loads of parts that were far more interesting than the bloody spear hero.
Who loves his chicken.
He better not go to Kentucky or Korea anytime soon.
When a man loves a chicken.
Just call him Colonel Sanders and be done with it.
Anyway, back to me. I've also been reading from Humanoids, Lucas Harahy's Swimming in Darkness. And this is basically the true story related to the author by his father of an architecture student who basically started trying to study the thermal baths in Switzerland, if you know what those are.
Yes, kind of.
So it's this big kind of multi-layered establishment, you know, for the weird angles and lots of water, as one would expect from baths.
Yeah.
So yeah, the student Pierre was doing a dissertation on them until something happened to drive him to a nervous breakdown and delete everything he had for reasons he himself can't remember. And so Pierre decides to travel back to Switzerland, start trying to study the baths again, because, you know, part of him's still obsessed with this structure. And while he's there, kind of starts uncovering a strange otherworldly secret to do with the architecture. And yeah, it's another fun little book. Kind of a sort of almost noirish feel to it, especially with the kind of, you know, lots of heavy lighting choices. That makes sense. It's all lots of shadows and tight angles. It's just nice. It's because it's like it's a mystery.
Yeah.
But kind of quite an unconventional mystery, because it's not like he's trying to solve a murder or anything. It's just, what's up with this weird building? And is it anything to do with kind of like all the local legends surrounding it?
Okay. Do you know what this sounds like? Do you remember that Mr. X I covered ages ago? You know, the actual cover was kind of architectural and stuff like that.
Can't say I do. But yeah, there's definitely a very heavy emphasis on kind of architecture. So lots of big pages, you know, detailed buildings and nice landscapes. It's a book with art that I like a lot because it's just very heavily detailed, but in a way that doesn't look cluttered. I think kind of the only thing I would have liked is it does seem a little bit short, especially towards the end.
Yeah.
But then I guess also kind of part of the it having quite an abrupt ending is, I guess, more to time with this idea of this is sort of like an urban legend that the guy's been told. So it kind of breaks that a bit. If maybe we do get a whole thing of Pierre, like, discovering every single secret and having this big confrontation and, you know, having everything neatly tied up rather than the slightly more ambiguous ending we do have.
Yeah.
So I understand why it does end like that, but part of me does like want to know what's going on with like all these hidden doors and like secret tunnels into the mountains. But no, it's a good little book. And if anything, you know, this and The Fourth Power have definitely kind of made me reappraise humanoids a bit. Because I know we have received quite a few of their books where we've just kind of either read them and not liked them.
Yeah.
Or just kind of said, okay, I don't really know what this is, and just chucked it in the to cover eventually pile. And you know, also sometimes it's tough because you want to do things like the big Marvel books because they're what people know. But I have actually had, you know, an enjoyable time digging into some of these weird, kind of slightly less mainstream books and adding neat little stories that you don't usually see.
Well, that's one of the nice things about comics. You know, they're all over the world from loads of different countries, and there's so many storytellers in comic books now that were spoiled for choice.
Because I think it is a big thing with going, well, we mostly cover American comics, and then find out that there's like a whole European comics market that is significantly different.
Yeah, but very much worth exploring. Okay, humanoids can be hit and miss, but when it hits hard, doesn't it?
You know, yeah, because that's, you know, even if I do have niggles about like both Fourth Power and Swimming in Darkness, they are very much like books that are unlike anything I've read in the last kind of couple of years or so.
Yeah. I mean, we've all covered humanoid stuff. Okay, you get stuff like The Inkle. That's part and parcel, but that happens with Marvel and DC and Image and Dark Horse as well. Oh, yeah. There's always going to be duds.
Yeah, I guess the thing with like Marvel and DC and Image and stuff is just we know a bit more about it, so we can maybe have a better chance of identifying, no, I think that's going to be a dud one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. But also there's the fact that a lot of the problem with something like The Inkle is that it's a very dense mythology to try and get into.
Yeah.
And you have no clues before you go into it. Whereas, obviously, with Marvel and DC and Image, the worlds are a bit more familiar and it's a lot easier to overcome that initial sort of shock of entering a new sort of storyline. Whereas,
I mean,
The Inkle and the Meta Barons are just, whoa.
See, this is the thing.
Actually, that does remind me of another point I was going to say about The Fourth Power.
Yeah.
Is that it did remind me a lot of something like, say, The Inkle or the Meta Baron, but because it's in this more like serialized, like set of stories, I think that both grounds it and, kind of restricts the scope a bit in a way that helps it a lot to feel less just dense and confusing.
Yeah,
and I think Jimenez did some of the artwork for Meta Barons and The Inkle.
I
covered his one of his solo stories, which was a sort of space adventure thing, and it just held together a lot better.
Yeah,
he clearly has a better understanding of story narrative than the work that he's previously only been an artist on.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is Jodorowsky just saying,
yeah,
I've just got a bunch of ideas and I'm just going to slap them on the page and I don't care what order they go in.
Yeah, but that's because Jodorowsky's... See, that music is definitely staying in because it just sums up Jodorowsky completely.
What, an ice cream van playing Match of the Day?
Yes.
I mean, it's about on the level of Vampires of the Mind, isn't it?
I mean, what is a meta baron? Why is he meta? Is he like a baron, but not like a baron, but also...
I don't know, but bizarrely, that is meta baron ices that are just driving down the road. So,
final one then. This is volume 3 of Grand Blue Fantasy, continuing the adventures through the skies of... Gran and Lyria and the rest of their airship crew as they basically...
Oh, I thought that was like the full title for a moment then.
No, it's just called Grand Blue Fantasy, thankfully. It's the manga adaptation of the game by Cygames, which also has a an anime adaptation which came out before the manga version, which kind of makes the manga version redundant, but not at the same time. Does that make sense?
I think we've talked about this one before, haven't we?
We talked about the first two volumes already. So anyway, this continues the story on, and you know, the artwork, the illustrations by Kocho are great. The layouts by Makoto Fugetsu are great. The character designs are taken from the game and the anime, and they're great. The actual paneling, the action scenes, the monster design, everything about this is great-ish. See?
Oh, that ish sounds significant.
It is. See, the problem I've got with Grand Blue Fantasy is that it literally says what it is on the cover. This is Grand Blue, you know, this is, and it's a fantasy story. And it is, and I've said it for the first two volumes, and I will say it again, it is the Ron Seal of manga. What you see is quite literally what you get. You want flying ships, and you want islands floating in the sky? You got it. You want dragons? You got it. You want magic? You got it. You want mystic swords and stuff like that, and magic weapons? You got it. You want, you want wizards and sorcerers and empires with schemes and conspiracies? You got it. Every single thing, every single trope you've had from the last 30-odd years of JRPGs is basically crammed into Grand Blue Fantasy. But it handles it quite well. Which is why it's, it's kind of, if you want to write a high fantasy story that's modelled on what your idea of a JRPG is, yeah? And you want it to have all sorts of elements in, then Grand Blue Fantasy is actually a good place to sit down, a good place to start and sit down and say, right, make a checklist based on just this. And it will see you in good stead. It's got a lot of the plot beats from numerous fantasy stories, more than I can name. And that's really... the story itself isn't... unless you know the story, right? Unless you don't know the story, and most people probably don't in the West, but it, you know, considering the game was quite popular and the anime adaptation went out and that did reasonably well as well. So most people probably do know the story. It's one of those things that'll appeal to people who have never read Grand Blue Fantasy and just like their high fantasy sword and sorcery stuff. But if you're like me and you are aware of it already, then it just becomes something that you can just pick up and say, oh yeah, I remember how this story goes, and then put it down again. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's just kind of retreading old ground.
Yeah, and not just retreading it for the first time. This is retreading it for like the second or third time. It's like, you know, the Hollywood adaptation of Old Boy, which is already adapted from a Korean comic? Or was it a Japanese comic? I can't remember.
Yeah, I assume Korean. It's a Korean film, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Korean film. So, yeah, it's like watching the Hollywood adaptation of an adaptation of a comic.
Yeah, because I guess like going from anime to manga, you're not really adding anything, are you? You're just sort of, you're taking stuff away.
Yeah. It's the thing with adaptations. Each time you adapt it to a different form, you basically remove things to fit the, so that it can fit that new form, or you make changes so it can fit that new form.
That's ideally like why a good adaptation changes things about to better suit that form.
Yeah.
The sort of discussion we have on our other podcast, Behold.
Yes.
Where we rank comic book adaptations. Also, I don't know why I'm acting like I'm being sneaky plugging it. It's my show, as is this. I can plug whatever the hell I want.
I was waiting for you to take it away. I'm done. So, continue.
Oh, okay.
I see, you were in a roller. I was just keeping silent. You are on a roll to take it to the end of the show.
Yeah, so listen to Behold. And if you also want to listen to episodes of 4Panel, you can find us at thegeekshow.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you are a fan of the show, please consider donating to the Geek Show Patreon, or just leaving us a review on iTunes or whatever podcast app you want, because that does help us grow and get noticed by more and more people. So, with that all said, that's us done for today. So, until next time, I've been Andrew.
I've been Rob.
And I've been Mick.
So, until next time, so long, and thanks for listening.